Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar-sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Who will emerge from the National League's Battle of the Expansions? And will the Cleveland-Boston Championship Series provide the same manic surprises as New York versus Boston would have? Ahead in Only a Game, MLB Playoffs Round 2. Also, the history of Olympic medal takeaways, givebacks, and other gold-plated intrigues. And a look back at the pennant race of 1897. Also ahead, rolling with Boston's North End bocce culture.
Let's start it with the ball. Four red and four greens. Usually the bushino is white, okay? In fact, it's the Italian flag.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Last night in Phoenix, the streaking Colorado Rockies made it 19 out of 20 and 2-0 over the Arizona Diamondbacks in the National League Championship Series. Colorado won this time on an 11th-inning walk. Game 3 will be Sunday night in Colorado. The American League Championship Series opened yesterday evening in Boston, where the Red Sox, led by Manny Ramirez and David Ortiz, hammered the Indians 10-3. The Indians will try to even that series at one game apiece tonight. Joining me now is Terry Pluto, who writes about sports for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Terry, are fans in Cleveland feeling A, still elated because they beat the Yankees, B, doomed, or C, both of the above?
I think Indians fans generally are always terrified about something terrible will happen to their team. I mean, in fact, we are convinced that I don't care all this Boston misery and all your celebrity mourners. By far, we are far more tormented in baseball than you guys or anyone else. So we could find gloom and doom under any sun, on any sunny day.
Some fans in Boston were relieved that the Indians beat the Yankees. Others were disappointed that there would be no New York-Boston confrontation in this postseason. Do the Indians and their fans care which team they play?
No, they just think it would be like Nirvana to knock off both Boston and New York, the two highest-paid teams in all of baseball with the little engine that could here. We like nothing better than, you know, standing up for flyover country and kicking the shins of whatever Goliath is in front of us. So, I mean, really, New York, Boston, bring them all on. I mean, it's just so cool to be playing at that table. I mean, for example, you know, in 95, they did knock off the Red Sox and they end up going to the World Series. I'm not going to mention 99, what happened there when they played the Red Sox, because that's like a really bad memory.
Absolutely. But the way you're talking, after Cleveland goes on to beat either the Diamondbacks or the Rockies in the World Series, maybe they'll play the Dodgers just for the heck of it.
Well, hey, no, I think they will take their winnings and go home. They're not stupid now. I mean, that's for sure. I mean, it only happens, let's see, 1920, 1948, and 2007? You know, could be. The other two common denominators, by the way, Bill, I don't know how you would do this unless I can activate Eric Wedge, is in 1920, Tris Speaker was a player-manager. In 1948, Lou Boudreau was a player-manager.
Well, Eric Wedge is still pretty young for a manager, you know, even though he's got that white beard coming.
Yeah, he shaved it, by the way.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, he's 39 years old, but he has like 79-year-old knees. That's what he told me. So, and by the way, managing here or any team for 5 years will probably give you an 84-year-old heart.
This year's Indians have seen some strange days. Due to freakish weather, they played home games in three different parks, including one in Seattle. They won one game in which they only got one hit. In one playoff game against the Yankees, a sudden bug infestation so discombobulated New York reliever Jabba Chamberlain that he threw two wild pitches, allowing Cleveland to tie the game. Cleveland eventually won that game. What does all this mean?
Well, I'll tell you this. We in Cleveland say, here's a guy in New York, and they always talk about how tough and how hard it is to play in New York with gangs and screaming fans and all this, and this guy gets some bugs on him and blows up. So we have no mercy for him. None. I mean, they're all over Fausto Carmona. He just pitched like it was no big deal. As of what it means, I mean, how about this? Casey Blake, a guy who was hitting 170 with runners in scoring position at the time, hit walk-off home runs twice in a four-day span to win games. So that was a big thing here because Casey's always sort of been the whipping boy of the fans, not because he doesn't try hard or isn't versatile, but just with in the clutch situations, he admits himself how much he struggles. And so then you throw in Bugs and you throw in Snow in early in the season, leading to three home games in Milwaukee. And in fact, if you go all the way back to the start of spring training, a former Red Sox, Keith Foulke, was supposed to be the closer. You know, he grabbed his elbow before spring training began and called it quits. So it wasn't like things that have been very smooth for this team from beginning to end. They're kind of very dogged and perseverant. You know, we Cleveland, all that blue-collar grittiness, we like all that stuff here, and the team's played like that.
It's a team that's hard to root against.
I enjoy them. Let's put it this way. I mean, they got a player from North Dakota, Travis Hafner. He thinks Cleveland's a big city. I mean, you got to like that.
Any worries that whatever mysterious forces might be attached to one of the other three teams still playing will overcome whatever mysterious forces, Bugs, et cetera, have been carrying Cleveland?
Yeah, you know, I'm just frightened that, like, good pitching is going to trump it all. I really am, and that's been the big thing there. I really think that one of the things we're going to see is a lot of, I don't want to say back-to-back 1-0 games like there was earlier in the year when the two teams got together, but a lot of low-scoring games. And then it's like, you know, who kicks the ball? And you know, I actually like those kind of games. I'm a baseball child of the 60s, and I remember, you know, Yaz winning the batting title, hitting 301 the one year. So I would love to see something like that.
Well, Terry, I guess you and I have canceled each other out because
right.
I'm on the record. I picked the Indians to win. You like the Red Sox.
Yeah, it just goes to show you live in these towns long enough, you lose faith in your own team, you know, apparently. I have nothing deeper than that to say.
Terry Pluto is a sports and religion columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and what better time to combine those two functions on behalf of the Indians. Terry, thank you very much for speaking with
me. Yes, it's time for dueling holy candles.
Last week, the NBA Europe Live Tour brought preseason games between four teams to Spain, Turkey, Italy, and England. Last weekend, the Toronto Raptors and the Boston Celtics pounded the hardwood and the cobblestone streets of Rome and were simultaneously the tourists and the attraction. Only a game's Nancy Greenlease was there, and she has this report.
Less than 24 hours after the Boston Celtics win over the Toronto Raptors in a sold-out preseason game, fans stream into a sports arena in Rome's southern suburbs. Tonight, Rome's professional team, Lottomatica Roma, takes on the Raptors and its star center, a man as Roman as Caesar. But as the game gets underway, there are still plenty of empty seats. NBA hoops have captured the eyeballs of soccer-loving Italians for one game, but not for two, even with Bargnani on display. The 21-year-old lands a shot, displaying the form that made him the first European to be a number one pick in the NBA draft. But the player known as Il Mago, or the magician, can't put a spell on Italian sports fans, most of whom are home watching the Milan-Lazio soccer game. Earlier in the week, Bargnani said he doubts his presence in the NBA will make the game more popular.
I don't think so much because in Italy we got just soccer, so basketball doesn't have so much space on the newspaper and everything. The people just know soccer.
Back at the game in Roma's arena, a handful of teenage boys wave yellow Lottomatica Roma bandanas. But they're jumping up and down for Roma and Toronto. 14-year-old Amadea Catania can't believe he's watching live basketball.
Tonight is very emotional because the NBA is here in Rome. And it's not every day that you see an American squad coming here to Italy.
In Italia.
Sitting courtside is the man who may be the country's next prime minister. Rome Mayor Walter Veltroni is a basketball fanatic. Just days before the primary, he escorted NBA players to charity events, thrilled to be in the company of anyone who could put the orange biscotti in the basket.
Because it is the most beautiful sport in the world, a sport of non-stop emotions and action, a sport that showcases talent and plays, a sport in which everything can change in the game's final seconds.
If Veltroni could legislate a new national pastime, he would. He wants Rome to host the EuroLeague final in 2010 and the World Championships in 2016. He's also supported NBA promotional events like one this summer. In Rome's historic center, the bells toll for churchgoers and devoted hoopsters. Hundreds of teens and 20-somethings are playing basketball in a 16th-century piazza on a Sunday. The NBA has plunked down giant orange basketballs next to an ancient obelisk and temporary courts. Italians may watch soccer, but their favorite sport to play is basketball. The NBA has noticed this and wants to make them into players and fans. It won't be tough to recruit 17-year-old Fabrizio Riza.
I hate football. It is prevalente.
Everywhere?
Yes. Not in America. There is a lot of basketball, baseball, soccer is not very... And I love America for this.
As sweat drips onto his Tracy McGrady jersey, Risa admits that his attempts at dunking on even a lowered hoop are clumsy. Few here are creating athletic artwork worthy of Michelangelo's homeland. But the young players are skilled ball handlers. Risa says he appreciates basketball's improvisational style.
It is fast, and you have to use your fantasy, always. And if you don't use fantasy, it's not a good sport for you. This is beautiful for me.
I just remember when people laughed in 1992 when I said that the gap between the U.S. and the rest of the world would close.
That's NBA Commissioner David Stern during halftime. He's watched as the quality and quantity of European basketball players have soared. Last year's NBA All-Star Game showcased five international players.
One need only look at the Toronto Raptor roster to see the internationalization of the game at every level.
Players from Spain, Slovenia, and Senegal teamed with Bargnani to help the Raptors to last year's Atlantic Division title. In turn, Lotomatica's newest star is an American import, former Celtic Alan Ray. Stern says an NBA regular season game could tip off soon in Europe and adds that new arenas in London, Berlin, and the one proposed for Rome make that much more likely. Stern also hints that the NBA could give the old world an expansion team. Back on the court, Roma isn't letting up. The score is tied at 66, heading into the fourth quarter.
Forza Lotomatica!
The Toronto-Roma game ends with a 93-87 Toronto win, and the teenage boys give a final cheer. One of the meanings of Forza is strength. And that's what Italian and European basketball needs to elbow its way into soccer's turf. The NBA has hinted at the possibility of more preseason games, which would help. Stern called the Grand Tour of Europe successful and says he hopes to make at least the Roman holiday into a tradition. For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlace in Rome.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. On September 30th, Roberto Madrazo competed in a marathon in Berlin. Suspicions about Mr. Madrazo's time of 2 hours and just over 41 minutes were aroused by the fact that Mr. Madrazo was wearing a jacket and long pants at the finish line, whereas all the other runners were in t-shirts and shorts. Then there's the fact that Mr. Madrazo's previous best time for a marathon was an hour slower, and the fact that the computer chip he was wearing indicated that Mr. Madrazo had failed to pass two checkpoints during the race. In 2006, when Roberto Madrazo ran for the presidency of Mexico, his opponents hung posters reading, "Do you believe Madrazo? Neither do I." And now people in Germany don't believe him either. We'll be right back. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game of Brawl. But first, this week, after admitting that she had taken a banned substance, Marion Jones returned the 5 medals she had won at the Sydney Olympics to the U.S. Olympic Committee, which in turn will return them to the International Olympic Committee. What happens to those medals after that is a matter of some speculation. Katerina Thanou, who finished second to Jones in the 100 meters at Sydney, would normally receive one of those gold medals, but Thanou was at the center of a doping affair hours before she was to compete in the 2004 Olympics in Athens. She has served a 2-year ban for violation of the doping rules. Ms. Jones is far from the first athlete to return an Olympic medal. Joining me now is Olympic historian David Walachinsky. David, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with the current situation. Is Katerina Thanou, the silver medal winner in 2000, likely to end up with the gold medal that's been gracing Ms. Jones's mantle for the past 7 years?
This is a very difficult situation for the International Olympic Committee. Normally, it would be a pleasure to give this gold medal to the person who had finished second. But Thanou, you were very polite in the way you described her problem. She tried to tell people that she'd been involved in a motorcycle accident, and that was why she wasn't there for her doping test. It turned out there was no motorcycle accident. She tried to check into a hospital and say that she was injured from this non-existent accident. But finally, it came out that there was no such thing, and she had to serve a doping ban. So to give her Marion Jones's gold medal would be ridiculous.
Passion Richardson, one of the members of the medal-winning relay team that included Marion Jones, spoke this week about her status as a medal winner. Here's what she had to say.
You know, the way that the world sees it is they were a team. If one is tainted, then they're all tainted. You know, they cheated, and they won by cheating. You know, and unfortunately, you know, we have to bear the shame of what she's done.
Jones isn't the first member of a relay team to be disqualified. Has the IOC asked athletes who haven't doped to return team medals before?
No. Well, yes, there's some very weird situations that don't have to do with doping where medals have been returned. But it's you know, this is a case in which, you know, Marion Jones was in the final. In other words, there's been situations where somebody doped, but they weren't in the final, they were in a preliminary, and they didn't ask anybody to return their medals. But this is a whole other situation. I mean, let's face it, also, there were two other runners on that team with Marion Jones who later served drug suspensions for different positive tests. So this is a fairly tainted team, and I think they really should give up their medals.
Other medal winners who've been caught cheating haven't been as cooperative as Jones. At the 2004 Olympics, Irina Korzenenko, a Russian shot putter, won a gold medal. She later tested positive for a steroid. It wasn't the first time that she had tested positive, and she was banned from Olympic competition for life. Initially, at least, she said she would not return her medal because she considered herself innocent. What leverage does the IOC have over an athlete who refuses to return a medal?
They have quite a bit of leverage. The same thing happened in 2004 with the Hungarian hammer thrower, Anus, who initially said that he wouldn't return his medal, and he finally did, because in both cases what the IOC does is they threaten the entire country's athlete. Mm. And so this burden becomes on you of, well, if you don't cooperate, then all your countrymen are going to be banned from the Olympics.
In another contemporary case of medal confusion, Colombian cyclist Maria Calle had to give back the bronze medal that she won at the 2004 Olympics when she tested positive for a banned stimulant. U.S. cyclist Erin Mirabella had finished fourth. She got that bronze medal, but the Court of Arbitration for Sport cleared Calle, and Erin Mirabella was asked to give Maria Calle back that medal. I wonder if temporarily being an Olympic medal winner is better than not being one at all.
Well, maybe at least you get to touch it. I mean, there was one case where one of the hurdlers was about to walk to the medal ceremony when they suddenly came running down and said, "No, we've studied the photo of the finish, and you were actually fourth." And they pulled her away. The poor woman. They pulled her away as she was walking up to the medal ceremony. She didn't do anything wrong. Nobody done anything wrong. It was just a review of the photo of the finish.
You know, David, what I'm really curious about is whether Olympic officials have ever had to go to somebody's door and knock on it to get a medal back.
Well, in reality, what happens is that the International Olympic Committee will go to the National Olympic Committee, who will then send a representative to the athlete's door. That's the way it worked with Ben Johnson and so forth. I'm terribly sorry, but we have to do this to you. But there are a couple stories. For example, in 1932, first of all, it was the first Olympics in which there was film of the events that was used to determine the winner.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 110-meter hurdles, there was an American athlete, Jack Kelly, who initially was given the bronze medal at the medal ceremony. Then they came to him and said, look, we've looked at the film of the race, and you were actually edged out. You placed fourth. And in the gentlemanly mood of the times, Jack Keller, he walked around the Olympic Village and he found the new bronze medalist, Donald Finley of Great Britain, and he actually personally gave him the bronze medal. So it can be, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be contentious.
Well, beyond the stories we've already told, do you have a favorite tale of medal controversy?
Oh, sure, yes. There's one of my favorite stories is the 1948 team dressage event. Team dressage is not one of my favorite events to begin with. This is an equestrian event. And in 1948, the gold medals were initially awarded to the Swedish team, with the French finishing second. But there were very strict rules at the time, which said that to compete in dressage, you had to be a commissioned officer. In other words, you couldn't be a civilian, and heaven forbid, you couldn't be a non-commissioned officer.
Right.
And somebody in the audience had noticed that a member of the Swedish team was only a sergeant. He was wearing the wrong uniform, and it just bothered the guy. And he filed a protest after the event was over. And 8 months later, the International Olympic Committee disqualified the Swedish dressage team and reawarded the medals to the French because of this terrible breach of etiquette where a non-commissioned officer had been part of the team.
And remarkably, some people are going to consider that the good old days.
That's it, exactly. Exactly.
David Walachinsky is the author of The Complete Book of the Summer Olympics and The Complete Book of the Winter Olympics. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
As the Rockies and the Diamondbacks contend for one pennant and the Red Sox and Indians contest the other, we'll turn now to a consideration of the pennant of 1897. 110 years ago, the Orioles of Baltimore and the Bean Eaters of Boston faced each other in what author Bill Felber maintains was an exceptional series of contests. Mr. Felber has written A Game of Brawl, subtitled The Orioles, the Bean Eaters, and the Battle for the 1897 pennant. He joins me now from Manhattan, Kansas. Mr. Felber, welcome to Only a Game.
I appreciate it. Good to talk to you.
I can't help asking right at the outset, how did you get Senator Edward Kennedy to write the foreword for this book?
Well, Senator Kennedy's grandfather, Honey Fitz, is a character in the book. He fits into the story of this season. So when I was developing the idea for the book and working on it, frankly, it occurred to me, I'm just going to message the senator and ask him. and I did that knowing a couple of things. First of all, knowing he's a big baseball fan. And he's also very much into the Kennedy-Fitzgerald family history. He has an appreciation for that, much to my delight and a little bit to my surprise, but not really. His staff respondent said he'd like to do it. So we did.
Now, Honey Fitz, of course, was a member of the Royal Rooters.
That's right, one of the originating members. And this the 1897 story deals in part with the origins of the Royal Rooters.
Even before the book proper begins, you tell a story about John McGraw, whom you characterize as, quote, the chief Oriole trickster, that reveals something about the way the game was played 110 years ago. Relate for us that particular competition between third baseman McGraw and base runner Pete Browning,
and
if you will.
And Pete Browning. This may be apocryphal. I can't say this actually took place, but it's been passed down so many times, and it certainly could be true. McGraw was known, had a reputation for holding the belts of base runners to slow them down. Now, you have to understand, There's only one umpire on the field. He can't watch everything. And so if the ball is up in the air and the umpire is watching the ball being caught, McGraw would slide over behind the base runner, tagging up at third base, and grab his belt and literally hold him in place so he got a late jump trying to score from third. It so happens that one day Pete Browning, who's a very celebrated ball player, is on third base. There goes the ball up in the air. McGraw slides behind. Browning's a veteran. He's been around the block. He knows what McGraw's going to do. He feels the tug. And Browning takes off for home plate and beats the throw easily. And there, standing at third base, is McGraw holding Browning's belt, which Browning had loosened so that it would slide out of his trousers when McGraw held it.
Perfect.
That's the kind of thing that occurs in 1897.
You write that, I'm quoting now again, the fight for the 1897 National League Championship says a lot about our cultural values at the turn of the century. What values or lack of same did you have in mind?
To oversimplify, this was a good versus evil kind of situation. I'm not sure the Bean Eaters were as holier than thou as they're sometimes portrayed, but they became the white hat guys. They were the force that was trying to demonstrate that winning by underhanded means was not necessarily always the best approach. And the country divided up along this line on this pennant race. Most people, frankly, rooting for the Bean Eaters, looking for the triumph of good over evil. There are a lot of other subcurrents to that. Some of the racial currents come through on this fairly strongly. And also the behavioral currents, swearing at the game, throwing beer steins, things like that.
The Orioles' style of play, which is described in your book as the dirtiest, cheatingest, most conniving ever put together, did have some consequences. Tell us what it cost the team after one particular exhibition game in Petersburg, Virginia.
The Orioles were playing an exhibition game in Petersburg against a local team. And this was a problem they ran into in various places, and they ran this risk when they would come down and play town teams with all the good old local boys and the good old local umpires. After this particular game, the crowd was so hostile, the Orioles were literally attacked on their way off the field by the fans. They escaped to the hotel to get their belongings. They were almost put under siege at the hotel, fled to the railroad to get out of town, and literally were chased to the railroad and they were very fortunate that the fans let them go and didn't abscond with the railroad. They were so angry.
As you did your research for a game of brawl and looked back from the perspective of 110 years, were you able to identify a turning point in this fabled Boston-Baltimore series?
The interesting turning point is more attitudinal, I think, than it is in any particular game. I think the decisive games, particularly the last three, really could have gone almost any way other than that the Baltimore manager, Ned Hanlon, obviously misused his pitching staff in the final series. He lost the last game 19-10 using pitchers who had pitched 2 and 3 days beforehand, and they were obviously worn out. But the more interesting aspect, I think, is the attitudinal change. The previous series between these teams, one was played in July, one was played in August, and they were marked by tremendous brawls, including brawls between players and umpires. So Baltimore had a first baseman named Dirty Jack Doyle, who was called Dirty Jack Doyle because he was a dirty player. It didn't have anything to do with his uniform or anything like that. And he was just a dirty player. And he picked some legendary fights, including in the August series, with a very well-known umpire named Thomas Lynch, who would be a future president of the National League, but was a very urbane umpire, known to dress nattily and various things. And they took shots at each other, literally came to blows on the field, if you can imagine such a thing. To go from there in 1 month to the kind of civility that moderated the feelings in Baltimore at the climactic series a short time later is a fascinating attitudinal turning point to me, and one that I can only ascribe to the fact that the Royal Rooters come down, and you know what? Deep down in the heart of the Baltimore fans, they're actually kind of impressed by this kind of loyalty.
I'm talking with author Bill Felber about his new book, A Game of Brawl. You're listening to Only a Game. You write that fans of the Boston team used to fill their pockets with beans and then throw them into the air if their team won.
That's right.
A magnificently quaint tradition. I wonder what happened to it.
This would be a good question to ask the folks who've done work on the Royal Rooters' history as a group. Not only that, they filled their pockets with coins And when a Boston player would make a particularly great play, they would throw coins at the Boston player, who would stop to pick up those coins during the game and make a fair amount of change. Typically, those coins would include plenty of dollar coins.
You write that that series that began on September 24th between the Orioles and the Bean Eaters was the most important series in the history of the National League. Why was that?
Well, it was, I think, a transformative series. Before the series is played, the mood in baseball, the atmosphere in baseball, is highly, highly confrontational. The game is a game of brawl. It is a lot of fighting, a lot of cutthroat play, a lot of cheating. And everybody expects when this series begins that it will be conducted in exactly the same way because that's perceived to be the only way that you can beat the Baltimore team. What actually takes place is quite the contrary and very different. They play three games. Contrary to all the other games that have been played between those teams in that season, these three games are played with great civility, with tremendous mutual respect among the fans from Baltimore and also the fans who've come down from Boston to see the game. And at the end, there are these remarkable scenes of fans actually saluting each other and singing each other's songs. And it's very much a changed attitude. That change doesn't continue for the rest of baseball history overnight. It is not that kind of turning point. But from there on, the game becomes much more civil and mitigates into the kind of game that we're more familiar with today.
Bill Felber is the author of A Game of Brawl, The Orioles, The Bean Eaters, and The Battle for the 1897 Pennant, published by University of Nebraska Press. He spoke to me from Manhattan, Kansas. Mr. Felber, thank you very much for joining
us. My pleasure. My pleasure.
If you pine for plentiful podcasts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast.
BBC! BBC! Baltimore baseball cranks are weak!
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The construction site offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
...450 high school students in Bismarck, North Dakota recently played Twister together. That's the game requiring players to wriggle and squirm around each other while they put their hands and feet on different colored circles. The students believe they've set a new world record for the largest Twister game board, with a mat measuring 4,699 square feet. But don't think this exercise was just a lark. The students are members of DECA, a business club that aims to improve education and career opportunities. So if any of these students are planning careers in taping together Twister boards and getting all tangled up with each other, they're all set.
We're gonna twist it, twist it, twist it, till we tear the house down. Come on and twist it.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. When you miss a shot in bocce, do they say you botched it? But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
You wouldn't know that the Yankees are out of the 2007 postseason based on the extent to which New York is in the news this week.
New York is in the news?
Yeah.
It's again?
Astonishing.
It's hard to believe.
So tell me this. Will relief pitcher Mariano Rivera get to determine who next manages the team?
Well, no, but he's going to get to determine whether or not he plays for the team, and I think the answer is a pretty conclusive no, since he has said pretty much that whether they keep Joe Torre or not will, quote-unquote, factor into his decision.
Hmm.
I suspect that they will not pick anyone to his satisfaction because they will be letting go the only guy that is to his satisfaction, and Mariano will then go ply his trade elsewhere.
Speaking of New York intrigue, NBA Commissioner David Stern this week angrily denied a New York Times headline that said Stern was not taking any action against team president and head coach Isaiah Thomas after the Knicks president and head coach was found liable in a sexual harassment suit. So what action is the commissioner taking?
He's being angry about being accused of not taking action.
That's action.
As he says, the headline said Stern not taking any action, but the article will be searched in vain to find me saying that. He expects himself to tell the New York Times, I'm not taking any action. And if he doesn't say he's not taking any action, that means he's not taking any action. My head is beginning to hurt.
Mine is,
go on,
too. I'm going to move right along to the return of Allen Houston to the Knicks. I don't know whether it helps or whether this will be a matter of, New York, you have a Houston problem.
Well, I think it is, New York, your team is a mess, and let's bring back one of the few people from the recent days who people have sort of universal good feelings about and see if he can hit us a couple of jump shots.
After this summer's cavalcade of scandals, I had hoped that we'd have a nice, calm autumn, but ATP is investigating 150, count them, 150 matches considered to be suspicious. Say it ain't so, Nikolai.
Yeah, apparently there's an offline betting site called Betfair, which voided a whole bunch of bets in August on a match because of quote-unquote irregular betting patterns. The ATP people have a document that says there might be 150 matches fixed in one way or another. This would be obviously a huge, massive, and very hard to recover from scandal.
Texas A&M head football coach Dennis Franchione has been sternly reprimanded by school officials for his double-secret newsletter to boosters, for which he charged a very handsome $1,200 for privileged information. What kind of information was he sharing?
Well, he made $37,000, almost $38,000 on this thing personally. So this was another underground revenue stream for a sport that requires several of those just to stay alive. I think the biggest problem that Texas A&M has with Dennis Franchione, he hasn't been the coach they thought he was going to, and they were lining up to fire him at the end of the season anyway. This is now a public embarrassment, so I suspect he'll be looking for other work.
So maybe he was just trying to put some money in the bank before he got fired.
Absolutely right, except he's got a contract that runs another 3 years at $2 million a year. I think he's going to be okay.
I think you're right. The USC football team of a few years back might turn out to be not quite as good as its record indicated, because its record could soon be changed due to the extracurricular fundraising activities of Reggie Bush. Have I got that about right?
Yeah, we don't know if this is the same thing's going to happen that happened to Oklahoma before, but a sports marketer is going to hand over to the NCAA a bunch of records linking Bush and his family to almost $300,000 in benefits that he got while he was at USC. This could wipe out a whole bunch of national titles and All-Americans. We might even see Bush having to give his Heisman Trophy back off this one. Yeah, it's going to be a big mess for a while, but you know what? The same thing happened to Oklahoma, and nobody talks about it now.
Would it be accurate to conclude that Terrell Owens is the only player in the National Football League who can cause a major controversy by writing a note to reporters?
Can I just say this? Get your popcorn ready!
That's what he said at the end
of the night. Good God! Get your popcorn ready! He left a note for his reporters. Dear reporters, due to the magnitude of this week's game and the high volume of questions for the original 81 about the other 81, which are actually singular people. He is the original 81. Randy Moss of the New England Patriots, who will be coming to Dallas this week, is the other 81. I will be taking all questions immediately followed Sunday's games. Sincerely, Terrell Owens. P.S. Get your popcorn ready! It makes everyone sound like James Brown. Huh! Get it to the bridge!
And I still don't understand why this is so upsetting.
Good God.
So many of our brethren in the sports
writing
community.
I just think it's unusual, and I think people are uncomfortable with the unusual. Oh, good God!
This game, by the way, to which you have referred, is New England-Dallas, two undefeated teams. Well, you tell me, is it too early in the season to be talking capital B big, capital G game?
No, this one is legitimately big. The Cowboys are a lot better than people thought they were. New England has to go on the road and play a really, really good team, as opposed to going on the road and playing Cincinnati, who turned out not to be a really, really good team. As much as you can have on the line in the sixth week of the season, this is it.
People like me who are inclined to root for players old with wandering over football fields and other hollow lands may have a quarterback for whom they can cheer this week, Charlie.
Yeah, the Carolina Panthers are running out of quarterback. Jake DeLome's out for the season. David Carr, your substitute, got hurt. Here comes Vinny Testaverde, last seen, by the way, taking snaps at practice for your New England Patriots, with a chance to play for Carolina this weekend.
Once, and he hopes, future Cincinnati Bengal linebacker Odell Thurman was suspended last year for violating the NFL's substance abuse policy. What do you think of Mr. Thurman's argument that the Americans with Disabilities Act entitles him to reemployment?
Well, the Americans with Disabilities Act categorizes people as disabled if they have a record of alcoholism and have gone through treatment, as he has. He says that the NFL is specifically declining to reinstate him because the officials in the league believe he is an alcoholic. And the Americans with Disabilities Act says that if they believe that, they have to allow him to present proof. And if he presents proof and presents proof that he's gone through treatment, they pretty much have to leave him his job back.
How widespread is this likely to be? Is this something that's going to change things
well,
in
I'm
the
sure,
NFL?
I'm sure there will be a judge to be found that says that somehow the NFL is immune to the laws that apply to everyone else. I have no doubt of that down the line.
This weekend marks the Rugby World Cup semifinals. Charlie, is it fair to say that so far in this tournament, surprises have been the order of the day?
Well, it surprises me is this thing is still going on. Didn't this thing start in February?
It's very
And we're
long.
Only at the semifinals? South Africa and Argentina playing in one semifinals, but England and France, the host squad, dispatching the favored team from New Zealand to get to the semifinals. That is the biggest shocker of the tournament.
Floyd Landis announced this week that he will appeal the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency decision that went against him to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. This is his last chance. Does he have any chance?
Who knows at this point? I suspect not. I think the Court of Arbitration for Sport now has a reason to make this thing go away. I suspect the end of Floyd Landis's roamings through the quasi-legal system that we've set up to handle doping in sports is pretty much here.
The ongoing search for sponsorship deals took an intriguing turn courtesy of an Italian soccer team this week. How do you suppose that the relationship between Trentino 1921 and Casa Bianca will work out?
Yeah.
Stop doing that.
We like it, don't we? We like the investment in our Trentino 1921 when it comes from the high-class broth escort agency, Casa Bianca, or White House. Oh, this will be fun. I can imagine the songs now. No, I can't. Let's not do that.
And finally, Charlie, there's evidence this week that at least in Benin, one group of soccer players is smart enough to know what to do when the opposition team includes the country's president.
They throw the game!
They let him score.
Yeah, the national team, the Squirrels, by the way, Benin Squirrels, were up 2-1, and lo and behold, the country's president was awarded a penalty kick, which, lo and behold, went in the net! If tennis could do it this well, they wouldn't be in such problems.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Yeah, baby. Daddy likes
soccer.
No, stop
that. You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Some neighborhoods are held together with bricks and mortar and a sense of community. Only a Game's Gabe O'Connor recently spent some time in a Boston neighborhood bound together by all of those things, as well as a game that unites young and old, the skilled and the unskilled, and residents and visitors. He has this report.
It's tiny, barely a square mile. And yet Boston's North End is home to some of the city's most important landmarks, like the Old North Church and Paul Revere's house. Adding to the old-world feel are narrow, curvy streets lined with brick buildings that house small mom-and-pop bakeries, even smaller apartments, and about a billion charming restaurants. The neighborhood is right on the waterfront. Boston's immigrant working class has landed here for centuries. First the Irish, then Jews, and then in the early 20th century, the Italians, who remain today. However, even that is changing.
There's
The Langone Recreational Complex sits on Boston's Inner Harbor, right next to the Coast Guard Station. There are two baseball fields which offer spectacular views of the USS Constitution and the Bunker Hill Memorial across the bay in Charlestown. Sitting in the middle of these two ballparks are three perfectly maintained bocce ball courts. Bocce, a kind of lawn bowling, is about as Italian as it gets, as North End resident Urbano Di Pietro explains.
Let's start with the balls. There's a little boccino. It's a diminutive of bocce, so it becomes a boccino, pallino, so-called. There are eight balls, four red and four greens. Usually the boccino is white, okay? In fact, it's the Italian flag.
The little white boccino, or pallino as it's usually called, is about the size of a racquetball. The pallino is rolled out on a narrow track to start a round. The red team and green teams take turns rolling their four grapefruit-sized ceramic balls towards the pallino. The object is to get them closer to the pallino than the other team. Di Pietro, a 30-year bocce veteran, explains his strategy.
You have to get the first ball near the pallino. You got to get the first ball near the pallino. Why? Because this way you got a head start. The other guy has to take the point away from you. Either he's going to botch it out, going to hit it out, or he's going to put it better than what you have now. And you got to have a little luck. With no luck, you're going nowhere.
Di Pietro is one of a few old-timers, the regulars they are sometimes called, who play bocce just about every day here when weather permits. This hot summer day, they are taking part in one of the neighborhood's two big bocce tournaments. This one is sponsored by the Massachusetts chapter of the National Italian American Sports Hall of Fame. A couple hundred people have crammed into the tight space to watch 64 teams of two take part in the all-day tournament. But no matter how many people are competing, these tournaments almost always come down to who can beat the regulars, who know the sandline courts better than anyone else. Their shots are so accurate, they sometimes wind up resting against the pallino 30 yards away. Regular Tony Penta knows bocce in the North End. It's usually guys like him, and there's a good reason for that.
Young kids, they went home with a girlfriend, just middle age, like a 60, 50, 70, they play, you know. This sport is like more for the middle age, you know what I mean? When you retire and that. A young generation, they play, but then they quit. They go to a different place, you know. They don't want to bother this kind of sport.
Does that bother you guys?
No, we love it, because it's a sport, you know, kill yourself.
All right, he's got the tips right there.
I love the sauce.
Sausage.
There are several large grills working off to the side of the courts. The salt air of the harbor has been replaced by the smell of steak tips and sausage. People line up to fill their plates while the smoke covers the courts and obscures the many Italian flags flying over them. Spectators hardly notice as they eat, drink wine, and visit. This seems more like a reunion than a competition, but reunions are temporary. Mark Verga of Providence explains there's more at work here.
This is one of the things that maintains that old tradition. And, the people that are here on a nightly basis are all the people from years ago. You know, it's the true Italians that grew up here, from when they were their grandparents, their parents, and themselves. But, you know, as we know, there are very few of them left.
In the 1930s, 44,000 people, mostly families and almost all Italian, were crammed into the North End's tenement buildings. Now, the neighborhood's population is about a quarter of that. Many families have been priced out of houses that average over $400,000. Living in them are single, young, mostly non-Italian professionals drawn to this trendy section of town. But not all of the North End's Italian Americans decry that change. Pam Donnarumma runs the Boston Post-Gazette, a neighborhood paper.
There aren't a lot of Italians in the North End right now, but there are a lot of wannabe Italians, if you want to say it that way. And they come here wanting to be Italian because they came down for dinner and all of a sudden they say, I want to live here because I go outside and I'm standing in the doorway and somebody starts talking to me. And when you live in suburbia, nobody talks to you. So I think more and more people want to come into the city. If it wasn't so expensive, I think we'd have more families.
Genuine Italians also have an interest in keeping the traditions like festas and bocce alive in the North End. Today is the last day of the Fisherman's Feast of the Madonna. When the tournament ends under the waning sunlight, almost everyone has left to catch up with their friends watching the parade on Hanover Street. Tim DeCastro drove an hour from Gloucester to be a part of everything.
You know, what little we can do, the other Italians from all over the place, we just come up here and show our support. Something as small as, even if it is not the authentic North End Boston, the Italians that from the old country that it used to be, we're going to carry on as much of it as we can. It will never disappear. It will never disappear. We won't let that happen because it is a huge part of our heritage as well as the guys who actually came here and started at the Women and Men. So whatever we can do, and this is, you know, every year we come out here, it's a start, you know. Just continue it on no matter how far it goes.
For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Boston.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Julian Saporiti, Peter Lydotes, Jonathan Peck, and Ron Jones at Kansas State University in Manhattan, Kansas, and Kathleen Adams at WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Gabe O'Connor's botchy photo gallery or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Olympic relay gold medalist Passion Richardson, a former teammate of Marion Jones. Ms. Richardson doesn't want to give up her medal because Jones took steroids.
At this point in time, you know, it's mine, so I'm going to continue to enjoy it.
Tick, tick, tick. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.